All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, February 28th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is an overcast 47 degrees, soon to be close to 60 today here in upstate New York, with a winter storm warning for tomorrow through Friday for 5 to 10 inches of snow. I got to tell you, it's been springing here for the last 3 days, so that's quite the disappointment. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Gadolinium, MRI, Brain, and Broken Healthcare, and we took a look at that contrast material that they give you when you get an MRI to take a look at your brain. Typically, it is for circulation issues, but there are other things. They can look at different organs in your body as well. But that dye has all kinds of FDA warnings and causes DNA damage and switch flipping and all kinds of crazy things. And it crosses the blood-brain barrier, which they don't seem to understand as well as they thought they did. Gets into your eyes and can cause some problems. So it was pretty disturbing to find out that something that they've been giving tens of millions of people worldwide can cause issues, and there are warnings, except they are still using it like nothing is wrong. So where we're going to continue today, I thought this was a great tie-in. I ran across this just a little while ago this morning. The reason why I started digging into gadolinium is that I ran across a story that caught my attention, because for the few weeks before that, we had been working on a story, and I don't know if anyone didn't see it. It was published on Monday at techspot.com on 5G, called The State of 5G, When It's Coming, How Fast It Will Be, and The Sci-Fi Future It Will Enable. But I got to tell you, this last story that we were working on, I was having a lot of trouble trying to concentrate, trying to focus my attention and get thoughts to work. I didn't have that internal voice that talks when you're writing. You know, a lot of times when you're really focused on something, you'll have the words just start forming themselves in your head. And I didn't have that. And it was really making me nervous. And I started digging into blood flow problems and brain and things of that nature, and that's how I came across that gadolinium issue. But check this out. So you know that I had the flu a couple weeks ago, and it was pretty nasty, and I'm still kind of suffering a little bit, not bad, but still a little bit chunky, if I can put it that way. But check this out. This is out of neuroscience.com. This is from yesterday, February 27th, 2018. Flu may impact brain health. A new mouse study reveals two different strains of influenza cause changes in both the function and the structure of the hippocampus that can last for a month post-infection. Now, how interesting is that? Now, one of the things I had read about the other day, I think it was out of the CDC, was that there are two strains of flu going on right now. There's that H3N2, which is the bad one, they say. And then there is a form of adenovirus that's going on that acts very much like a flu or a severe cold. But we had read before about people such as Georgie Porgy Church using adenovirus and CRISPR tools to be able to get into the neurons and flip switches on and off. And I don't know if they were using those opsins for some sort of optogenetics or what exactly they were doing or how they were doing it. But it's just interesting to note that now a story has come out that flu may actually impact your brain health and target a certain section of the brain, such as the hippocampus. Female mice infected with two different strains of flu exhibits changes to the structure and the function of the hippocampus that persists for up to a month after flu infection, according to new research published in the J Neuroscience Journal. Although influenza is considered a respiratory disease, it has been associated with neurological symptoms in some cases, and however, the long-term effects of flu on the brain have not been studied. Martin Court and colleagues investigated three different flu strains, H1N1, H3N2 and H7N7 in mice, and two of these strains, H3N2 and H7N7, caused memory impairments that were associated with the structural changes to neurons in the hippocampus. What? So we have viruses falling from the sky, we discover. And I got to tell you, that was what was so strange about this flu, is that no one else in my household ever got sick from it. And I hadn't been out a few weeks before I had gotten sick. And the only thing that I really had done was sat on a couch in front of an open window and enjoyed fresh air one afternoon. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So unless it came in on my family's shoes, I don't know where it came from. These infections also activated the brain's immune cells in this region for an extended period and altered the expression of genes implicated in disorders, including depression, autism, and schizophrenia. What? The findings suggest that some strains of flu may pose a threat to healthy brain function. And that is the end of the story. So that definitely caught my attention because I really think I was suffering from something like that. There was something going on in my head that wasn't normal and I knew it. And I started digging into potential reasons why. So now let's go in the same journal. Here was another story that came out the other day, February 22nd, 2018. And again, we had read about this a long time ago using fMRI. So getting back to MRIs and contrast. But this is doing it a different way. Mind reading algorithm uses EEG data to reconstruct images based on what we perceive. What? What we perceive. Oh, yes. What you have seen through your eyes. Researchers have developed a new technique that uses EEG data to reconstruct images based on how we perceive faces. This is from the University of Toronto. A new technique developed by neuroscientists at the University of Toronto can, for the very first time, reconstruct images of what people have perceived based on their brain activity gathered by EEG. The technique, developed by Dan Nemdrov, a postdoctoral fellow and assistant professor Adrian Nestor's lab of the University of Toronto in Scarborough, is able to digitally reconstruct images seen by a test subject based on EEG data. When we see something, our brain creates a mental perception, and it is essentially a mental impression of that thing. And we were able to capture this precept using EEG to get a direct illustration of what is happening in the brain during this process. For the study, test subjects hooked up EEG equipment. Remember, it's portable and cheap now. And were shown images of faces, and they want to put them in schools. We read about that a while ago. Their brain activity was then recorded and then used to digitally recreate the images in the subject's mind, used a technique based on machine learning algorithms. So they're going to be able to turn people into surveillance cameras. Think about that one. It is not the first time that researchers have been able to reconstruct images based on visual stimuli using neuroimaging techniques. And we had read about this one a long time ago. The current research method was pioneered by Nestor, who successfully reconstructed facial images from fMRI data in the past, but this is the very first time that an EEG has been used. And while techniques like fMRI, which measure brain activity by detecting changes in blood flow, can grab finer details of what is going on in a specific area of the brain, the EEG has greater practical potential. Given that it is more common, portable, and inexpensive by comparison, and that was an RFP that DARPA put out a long time ago, to come up with a cheap and portable EEG that can be given to people in their homes and for children in schools who want to go into wink STEM technologies. EEG is also greater temporal resolution, meaning it can measure with detail how a precept develops in time, right down to the millisecond. fMRI captures activity at the time scale of seconds, but EEG captures activity down to a millisecond, so we can see with very fine detail how the precept of a face develops in our brain using EEG. In fact, researchers were able to estimate that it takes the brain about 170 milliseconds to form a good representation of a face we see, and this study provides validation that EEGs have the potential for this type of image reconstruction, and something that many researchers doubted was possible given its apparent limitations. using EEG data for image reconstruction has great theoretical and practical potential from a neurotechnical standpoint, especially since it is relatively inexpensive and portable. Think about this. I thought we had read a while ago about the new sunglasses that had EEGs built in so they could determine what your mood is or how you're feeling and then maybe give you a zippity zap or stream some music to change your mood into your ears. Well, this is going to be the next step. And maybe those sunglasses have a little camera that are reading that data and streaming images via something like 5G to a data center somewhere far away. It could provide means of communication. This, of course, is going to be for those people who are paralyzed and cannot verbally communicate, because this will cure you or at least give you the ability to communicate with others. Not only could it produce a neural-based reconstruction of what the person is perceiving, but also what they remember and what they imagine of what they want to express. Could also have forensic uses for law enforcement and gathering eyewitness information on potential suspects rather than relying on verbal descriptions provided to a sketch artist. So they're just going to put this EEG on your head and suck the images out. Oh my God. The research, which will be published in the journal eNeuro, was funded by the Natural Sciences and Engineering Council of Canada and the Connaught New Research Award. What is really exciting is that we're not reconstructing squares or triangles, but actual images of persons' faces, and that involves a lot of fine-grained visual detail. The fact that we can reconstruct what someone experiences visually based on their brain activity opens up a lot of possibilities. Yeah, lots of scary ones as well. And it unveils the subjective content of our mind, and it provides a way to access, explore, and even share content with our perception, memory, and imagination. How frightening is that? So here's another paper that a friend of mine ran across the other day when we were researching 5G for our article. And this one was pretty frightening as well. I don't know if I'm going to read this whole thing because it's kind of long, but I will link to it in the notes for anyone who's interested. 5G wireless communication systems, heterogeneous network architecture and design for small cells, D2D communication, and that would be low-range multi-hop, and wearable healthcare systems on a chip, and that would include not only EEG, but ECG, which is for your heart, for 5G wireless. The major challenges in 5G wireless communication systems are very high data rate, very low latency, very high mobility, very high density of users, very low energy cost, and massive numbers of devices, which cannot be addressed by the existing 4G LTE systems. In this paper, heterogeneous network architectures proposed for the prospects of 5G wireless communication systems to address the future demand of network capacity and seamless link for distributed radio access technology. One of the big things they're talking about doing for launching 5G, and I don't want to get into a 5G discussion, but just to kind of explain this, heterogeneous means many different types, so they are kind of doing a quote-unquote upgrade extension to the existing cellular networks to begin with, and that is going to interact with the current 3G and 4G that's out there, and then put this 5G leg that'll be for communicating at higher speeds and multi-in, multi-out, so they could splice up chunks of the frequency spectrum and do them in the 100 megahertz chunks, send data multiples across all those bandwidths at the same time to be able to then bond them together at the other end and get the higher speeds. So, I don't know, blah, 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 blah. So hold on one second. Let's get down to this brain communication because it goes through small cells, blah, 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 blah. Well, we might skip it because I can't find it. Simulations, I don't know. Anyway, 5G wireless for EEG and ECG for your wearables. And you know that is coming. That's going to be our new healthcare system. Remember, JP Morgan Chase, Amazon, and Berkshire Hathaway are all working on coming up with a new way to come up with cheap healthcare and be able to monitor us, bag and tag, and track you with gauges to make sure that you're healthy at all times. So we ran across a story last week about a scientist, a neuroscientist out of Africa somewhere, I think Tanzania maybe, that integrated neurons, live brain cells, into a computer chip to create a computer chip that can actually smell. He's going to put it into a drone that can smell explosives. And then he was talking about later maybe putting it at airports. And they can put these little sensors all over the place, giving a sense of smell to the machine. Let's take this a step further, because I ran across a story this morning. This is with all this brain study that is going on, part of the Brain Initiative. And that's just not a United States initiative. It is a global initiative. The brain, they have discovered, can navigate based solely on smells. Novel olfactory virtual reality system allows researchers to study how smells influence behaviors. Remember, it's all about behavioral monitoring and this future of EEGs in every pot. They can then monitor via 5G back to a dashboard. It's going to figure into all of this. They can not only gather visual images via EEG, but I bet you they can also read smells and the interactions that they have in different areas of your brain. Northwestern University researchers, and this is February 26, 2018, Northwestern University researchers have developed a new, quote, smell virtual landscape that enables the study of how smells engage the brain's navigation system. The work demonstrates for the very first time that mammalian brains can form a map of its surroundings based solely on smell. The olfactory-based virtual reality system could lead to a fuller understanding of odor-guided navigation and explain why mammals have an aversion to unpleasant odors, an attraction to pheromones, and an innate preference to one odor over another. The system could also help tech developers incorporate smell into current virtual reality systems to give users a more multi-sensory experience. And, you know, we've been waiting for smell-o-vision for a very long time. I know that there was a point back maybe in the 90s where they talked about a USB smelly device that you could plug in and then interact when you came across things. There'd be like a little scratch and sniff online, and it'll release esters that would then make different smells. And here they even said, we have even invented what we jokingly call smell-o-vision. And that was actually big in the 70s, I think, with Divine. They had those little cards they gave out when you went to the movies to go see polyester or something like that. And it would say, scratch one, and you'd scratch it and sniff it, and it would go along with whatever was going on in the scene. It is the world's first method to control odorant concentrations rapidly in space for mammals as they move around. The study was published February 26th in the Journal of Nature Communications. Researchers have long known that odors can guide animal behaviors, but studying this phenomenon has been difficult because odors are nearly impossible to control as they naturally travel and diffuse in the air. But by using virtual reality systems made of smells instead of audio and visual, Dombeck and graduate students created a landscape in which smells can be controlled and maintained. Imagine a room in which each position is defined by a unique smell profile. And imagine that this profile is maintained no matter how much time elapses or how fast you move through the room. This is exactly what Dombeck's team developed using mice in their study and aided by a predictive algorithm that determined precise timing and distribution. The airflow systems pumped scents such as bubblegum, pine, and sour smell past the mouse's nose to create a virtual room. Mice first explored the virtual environment through visual and olfactory cues, and researchers then shut off the visual virtual reality system, forcing the mice to navigate the room in total darkness based on olfactory cues alone. The mice did not show a decrease in performance, but instead, the study indicated that moving through the smell landscape engages the brain's spatial mapping mechanisms. And not only can the platform help researchers learn more about how the brain processes and uses smells, but it also lays the groundwork for human applications. Of course it does. Development of virtual reality technology is mainly focused on vision and sound, and it is likely that our technology will eventually be incorporated into commercial virtual reality systems that create a more immersive, multi-sensory experience for humans. The study is titled An Olfactory Virtual Reality System for Mice. The research was supported by the McKnight Foundation, the Klingstein Foundation, the Whitehall Foundation, the Chicago Biomedical Consortium, with support from the seed funds of the Chicago Community Trust, the National Institutes of Health, and the National Science Foundation. So it's pretty interesting that they are now looking at ways to utilize another one of the senses to manipulate behavior, because it seems to be a connecting thread to a lot of these different technologies that we've been looking at, as they have been cracking the secrets of the brain. Where's another one? We've talked about this before. This is moving artificial intelligence out to the edge of the network instead of putting it in the cloud, which is, like I've always talked about, the big pulsating brain in the sky. One of the problems with that is that it's going to suck up bandwidth to be doing all that computing and sending information back and forth all the time over those connections. So instead, we've talked about making things smaller, faster, smarter. Well, this one is again out of Northwestern University, same place that's using the smells for navigation. February 21st, 2018, MEM transistor brings the world closer to brain-like computing. Computer algorithms might be performing brain-like functions, but such as facial recognition and language translation, but the computers themselves have yet to operate like brains. Computers have separate processing and memory storage units, whereas a brain uses neurons to perform both functions. Neural networks can achieve complicated computation with significantly lower energy consumption compared to a digital computer. And remember, they also have come up with the artificial synapses that move a lot faster and lower power than human synapses. In recent years, researchers have searched for ways to make computers more neuromorphic or brain-like in order to perform increasingly complicated tasks with higher efficiency. Now, Hersham, a Walter P. Murphy professor of material science and engineering at Northwestern's McCormick School of Engineering, while that was a mouthful, and his team are bringing the world closer to realizing this goal or nightmare. The research team has developed a novel device called a MEM transistor. I don't know if that is the same thing as a memristor, but I would think that it's somewhat close to some of the things that they've been doing, which operates much like a neuron, performing both memory and information processing. And with combined characteristics of a memristor, and a transistor, the MEM transistor, so it's not the same, also encompasses multiple terminals that operate more similarly to a neural network. Supported by the National Institute of Standards and Technologies, more affectionately known as NIST, and the National Science Foundation, the research was published February 22nd, 2018 in Nature. And Vinod K. Swagen and Hong Sub Lee, postdoctoral fellows advised by Hersham, served as the paper's co-first authors. The MEM transistor builds upon work published in 2015, where they used a single layer molybdenum disulfide to create a three-dimensional gate-tunable memristor for fast, reliable digital memory storage. The memristor, which is short for memory resistor, are resistors that in a current that remembers the voltage previously applied, and typical memristors are two-terminal electronic devices which can only control one voltage channel. By transforming it into a three-terminal device, they have now paved the way for memristors to be used in a more complex electronic circuit and system, such as for neuromorphic computing. To develop the MEM transistor, the team began to use anatomically thin MOS2, which is that molybdenum disulfide, with a well-defined grain boundaries, which influence the flow control. Similar to the way fibers are arranged in wool, atoms are arranged in ordered domain called grains within a material. And when a very large voltage is applied, the grain boundaries facilitate atomic motion, causing a change in resistance. I don't know. So we believe that this MEM transistor can be a foundational circuit element for new forms of neuromorphic computing. And however, making dozens of devices, as we have done in our paper, is different than making a billion, which is done with conventional transistor technology today. Thus far, we do not see any fundamental barriers that will prevent further scale-up in our approach. So let's start making billions of these devices and put them at the edge, and that's what a lot of the research papers are talking about right now, to speed up our science fiction scary-looking future. And let's add insult to that injury, because as Amazon is getting into the healthcare industry, and they will even, they were even talking about doing drug delivery in fulfillment, as well as fulfillment for hospitals. And we read in one story, they'll even maybe be offering a hip replacement that hospitals can source through them. Amazon also has designs on AI chips. And this is out of Barron's.com, February 25th, 2018. NVIDIA is slowly picking up some formidable competitors in the AI chip making business. Amazon has now joined Alphabet and Apple in designing its own custom chips, according to a report in The Information. Amazon is making specialized chips for its Alexa home speakers, and it may be eyeing chips for its Amazon Web Services data center, the report says. Either scenario could spell trouble for AI chip leaders NVIDIA and Intel. Amazon's acquisition of Annapurna Labs, which is an Israeli-based chip maker, for $350 million in 2015, and Blink, the maker of low-power security cameras, for $90 million last year, has enhanced its chip-making operations. Alphabet, which has invested in custom hardware for years, recently raised the curtain on its second-generation tensor processing unit specifically for AI neural networks. For now, NVIDIA investors have little to worry about. The Silicon Valley's company has an impressive quarter, and it gleaned most of its revenue from gaming. And they're also using it to do crypto mining. Data center revenue accounted for 21%. So now let's talk about putting AI into end-user devices. This one came out of the New York Times, and if you've been out there lately more than a few times, they're going to put up a paywall. But apparently on this machine I haven't been, but upstairs I was. This one is yesterday, February 27, 2018, out of the New York Times, titled "The Sublime and Scary Future of Cameras with AI Brains." Yes, this is pretty freaky. Something strange, scary, and sublime is happening to cameras, and it is going to complicate everything you knew about pictures. Cameras are getting brains. Well, we probably could have guessed this one. Until the past few years, just about all cameras, whether smartphones or point-and-shoot or CCTV surveillance, were like eyes disconnected from any intelligence. They captured anything you put in front of them, but they didn't understand a whit about what they were seeing. Even basic facts about the world eluded them. It's crazy, for instance, that in 2018, your smartphone does not automatically detect when you have taken a naked picture of yourself and offer to house them under an extra special layer of security. But all of this is changing. So look out. There is a new generation of camera that can understand what it is seeing and take those naked pictures and forward them to the special NSA database. And no, I just added that, but sure, why not? Their eyes connected to brains. This again is adding more senses and more brains to the machine. Machines that no longer see what you just put in front of them, but they can act upon it, creating intriguing and sometimes eerie possibilities. At first, these cameras were promised to let us take better pictures, to capture moments that might not have been possible with every dumb camera that came before it. And that is the pitch Google is making with Clips, a new camera that went on sale Tuesday. It uses so-called machine learning to automatically take snapshots of people, pets, and other things that it finds interesting. Oh, God. Others are using artificial intelligence to make cameras more useful. You have learned how Apple's newest iPhone uses fake facial recognition to unlock your phone. A startup called Lighthouse AI wants to do something similar for your home using a security camera that adds an additional layer of visual intelligence to the images it sees. When you mount its cameras to your entryway, it can constantly analyze the scene, alerting you if your dog walker doesn't show up or if your kids aren't home by a certain time after school. It doesn't take a long time to imagine the useful and very creepy possibilities of a camera that can decipher the world around it. And digital cameras brought about by a revolution in photography. But until now, it was only a revolution of scale. But thanks to microchips, cameras got smaller and cheaper, and we began to carry them everywhere. And now with artificial intelligence, they create a revolution in how cameras work. Smart cameras will let you analyze pictures with prosecutorial precision, yeah, and the cops, and raise the specter of a new kind of surveillance, not just by government, but by everyone around you, even your loved ones at home. The companies making these devices are aware of the privacy dangers, but screw it. We can make money on it. And many are moving into the field gingerly, slathering their products with safeguards that they say reduces the creepiness. Take Google's Clips, for example, which I have used in the past week and a half. It is one of the most unusual devices that I, the author, has ever encountered. The camera is about the size of a tin of mints, and it has no screen, right, so you can't delete things. And on its front, there is a lens and a button. The button takes pictures, but it's only there if you need it. Instead, most of the time, you just rely on the camera's intuition, which has been trained to recognize facial expressions, lighting, framing, and other hallmarks of a nice photo. It also recognizes familiar faces, the people you're with more often than those it deems to be more interesting to photograph. Clip sells for about $249, which makes pictures unconscious and all but invisible, and carrying it around wherever you go, the camera has a handy case with a big bendy clip so it can be affixed to your jacket, set on a tabletop, or carried in your palm, or anywhere else with a view. But from there, it's all AI, so bring your real surveillance device with you. Clip catches the scene, and when it sees something that looks like a compelling shot, it captures a 15-second burst picture, something like a short animated GIF or a live photo on your iPhone. I took a trip with my family to Disneyland last week, and over two highly photographable days, I barely took a photo. Instead, this tiny device automatically did the work, capturing hundreds of short clips of our vacation. Some of them were really quite good, getting high points of our trip in the same way I might have with my phone, but there is the clip of my son driving a car. But what was really interesting was the stuff that I wouldn't have consciously captured. I got dozens of pictures like these, and this looks like his kid's fighting, or his kid flying, or running with a football, and the kid's dancing. Aesthetically, these pictures are masterworks. Emotionally, they are on a higher plane. Clips caught moments of my kids goofing off, fighting, and Disney's endless lines, playing catch at home, dancing like adorable maniacs, and moments too spontaneous and seemingly slight for me to have caught it with my camera. But that'll probably paint more of an accurate and edifying picture of our lives in the last 30 years. Regular readers of this comment know that capturing moments of my kids' childhood is an acute anxiety of mine. I even wired my home with cameras to preserve a kind of reality show of life in my house. Oh my God, you lunatic. He's put his kids under surveillance. But you don't have to be as crazy as I am to share slivers of this fear. that your kids or your pets are constantly doing things that you will later want to remember, but that your smartphones often miss. An intelligent camera gets these times, but it doesn't ask you to break the moment to capture them. But obviously, setting up a camera that doesn't need to be specifically triggered to take a picture is problematic. I'd say so. And this raises the worry of spying, that Google can spy on you or that you can use it to spy on others. Google addresses that creepiness in two ways. The device is mostly unconnected from the internet. Well, whew, good thing. And it can take pictures without a connection, and it requires your phone for viewing or for saving clips. But even then, all of its AI happens on the device, and it doesn't even need you to have a Google account, the company says. We spent a lot of time thinking about privacy and making sure that it was a device people would actually want. What we learned was that cameras don't creep people out when they are used deliberately and the person is part of the process. Yeah, let's manipulate you. Clips also raises the memory of other products in this vein, including Snap Spectacles and Google's Glass, and the search company's failed attempt to get consumers to use glass that takes photos. But to ensure that clip is designed to look like a camera, so when it is on, it flashes a white LED signal to let you know that it is recording. Or maybe that could be turned off somewhere so it can operate in stealth mode. Who knows? But it also does not record audio because that might have left it feeling too much like spying. Lighthouse, which I have also used for a few weeks, is meant to be an upgrade over the internet-connected home security camera that have become popular, and these devices can be annoying because they freak out every time they spot any movement. Lighthouse's special trick is a camera system that can sense 3D space and learn to recognize faces, intelligence meant to avoid false alarms. It also has a nifty natural language interface so that you can ask it straightforward questions like, what did the kids do when I was gone? And it'll show you clips of your kids while you were gone. Oh my God. Lighthouse, which sells for $2.99 and requires a $10 monthly subscription fee, feels like a work in progress, and it was most accurate in differentiating people in my house, but it also was tripped up into thinking I had an intruder by a Nylar balloon floating around in my living room. The company is young and I expect its software to improve. I can see it being a genuine use to people who wonder what is happening at home when they are away. If you want to know if your dog is jumping on your couch, ask Lighthouse. It can recognize dogs jumping around on couches and it'll instantly show you the clip. It's a little snitch in your house. So while it can get close, I don't have a dog, so when I asked Lighthouse about that question, it pulled a clip of my kid kicking his stuffed tiger off the couch. But what if it's your spouse, not your pooch, that you're worried about? I trust my wife, but for the sake of this column, I asked the device to show me any clips of her in the house with an unfamiliar person. Oh my God. So there she was one evening with the babysitter whom Lighthouse hadn't seen before. It was a case of straight up spying on my family, but it is an obvious possibility with a camera that understands the world so well. Alex Tixman, Lighthouse's chief executive, said that it could safeguard against inter-family spying, for instance, by restricting face identification only to unrecognized faces. He also pointed out that the system has numerous fine-grained privacy controls that allows you to turn off any recording when certain family members are present. I found his response credible, and both Lighthouse and the clips are well-crafted against abuse, and it should be noted that neither one allows for much more spying than we can already accomplish with smartphones. Constant social surveillance is the norm in 2018. But they are guides to the future. Tomorrow, all cameras will have their capabilities, and they won't just watch you, they will understand you too. So what do you think about them, apples? So let's go a step further. This one is out of Yale News, news.yale.edu. And we have talked about this computer before called True North. And it appears to be housed at Lawrence Livermore's laboratory, created by IBM and funded by DARPA's Synapse program. New research creates a computer chip that emulates human cognition. Oh, yes. Imagine working in an office where once you have finished one task, you had to wait until everyone in all the other cubicles completed that task that they were working on before you can move on to your next assignment. That is how most digital devices that rely on synchronous circuits work, and built-in clocks allow the same amount of time for the completion of each computational function. Based on a binary system of zeros and ones, it is reliable, but it also means that the system can run only as fast as its slowest function in the chain. In a clocked implementation, and that's every motherboard has a clock, everything has to fit into a time budget. So unless you make everything faster, your chip doesn't run any faster, and everything that includes things that you don't always need. Even before Siri and Google's Home became our household companions, we had a tendency to anthropomorphize computers, though I've never given my computers a name. Except for maybe Rust Bucket. It has long been common for people to speak of computers in terms of thinking and to ascribe them brain-related traits. And in truth, though, conventional computers really don't function like brains at all. But computer science is getting closer with neuromorphic chips. One sign of this is True North, which is a 4-square-centimeter chip that possesses some 5.4 billion transistors and 1 million neurons that communicate via 256 million synapses in just 4 square centimeters. Starting while he was a faculty member at Cornell, Manohar came to work on the chip with a team of IBM researchers in a years-long collaboration that resulted in True North. Funded by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, as part of its Systems Neuromorphic Adaptive Plastic Scalable Electronics, more affectionately known as the Synapse Program. True North is a pioneered example of a neuromorphic chip, which is a new breed of computer circuitry modeled after the brain. It is the size of a postage stamp, and it could be the start of a revolution on how we make and use computers. And then let's give it eyes and sense of smell, and you can just imagine the future. Mohar, who started at Yale in January, came to the project through his work with asynchronous systems, which was one of his specialties, and in devices with these types of circuits, each function is allowed as little or as much time as it is needed to complete the task. It is like a relay race. You hand the baton to the next person when you're there, he said. To allow for greater complexity and use much less energy, all of these functions are working asynchronously and in parallel, similar to how neuroscientists believe that the brain operates. There is clearly not a single carefully synchronized signal that goes through every single neuron in your brain, so it seems that asynchrony is a natural way to think of how computations there occur. And although asynchronous systems are often thought of as a new branch within computer science, and I thought maybe there was a little bit of how quantum computing worked, it isn't just zeros and ones, it's zeros and ones in this other state. Their root goes back to the earliest versions of a modern computer. Manohar notes that even the blueprint of the modern computer, which is the von Neumann machine from the 1940s, explains that asynchronous computation is advantageous. And many early machines were built this way, but computer architecture soon grew in complexity and included a lot more wires, so ensuring that signals were sent and received correctly within the machine got trickier, and an internal timekeeper was needed to make sure that things ran properly, and synchronous circuits became the law of the land. But what machines gained in orderliness, though they lost in speed. Take, for instance, the computer in your phone. It is running at 1 gigahertz, which is, well, maybe yours is, mine isn't, which is 1 billion steps per second. So every step has to fit in 1 nanosecond. Whatever you're calculating has to be subdivided into equal blocks of time. And if one step finishes early, well, you're going to have to wait. That'll add up to a lot of wasted time. So frankly, it is rare if you have computations where individual things all take the same amount of time. Not all computations are as equally difficult. So if one step takes too long, an error occurs, and in that case, the process has to be broken down into smaller steps, and the step size has to be bigger, and that slows everything else down. So nonetheless, that didn't pose much of a concern until the 1980s, when chips started to get bigger and more complicated, and the clocks used to keep up with the computing power got more and more expensive to run, taking up to as much as 20% of the computer's power consumption. So back in the 1980s, people started looking at asynchronous circuits again, and the neurons of true north work in parallel with each other, each doing what it needs to do to complete a task, and then they communicate via bursts of electrical current known as spikes. One of the most remarkable things about true north is how power efficient it is. It draws only 70 milliwatts of power, equal to that of a hearing aid, and its consumption is quite minuscule compared to conventional computers performing a similar task. The lead researcher of the cognitive computing group at IBM, who is the principal investigator of the DARPA Synapse Project, said that he recruited Manohar because he is the world leader in technology required for the project, and he had developed powerful and proven tools. Neurons in the brain are event-driven and operate without any synchronizing clock. No, they probably react to stimuli. And to achieve this ambitious metrics of DARPA Synapse, a key element was to design and implement event-driven circuits for which asynchronous circuits are natural. Neuroscience has given us a much better understanding of what is happening in the brain, and that is by design. And that information inspired the architecture of the True North chip. But it is a stretch to call True North a copy of a brain's function, since we don't know exactly how the brain works, but we're getting closer. And that is one of the things that fascinates Manohar about his work. The brain is an asynchronous system, and we don't really understand it very well, but it can do certain things that we don't know how to get computers to do today, and that is very interesting. He said there is also evidence that the brain is a massively powerful asynchronous computational substrate that can learn how to do a lot of different applications, and it can execute all of those applications at an efficiency that we do not know how to do in a computer. So many other efforts in neuromorphic computing start with the aim of better understanding how the brain works. And the makers of True North approach their project from another direction. That is, how can the processes of the brain make for better computing? And it is not that I want to understand biology, says Manohar. I am into it to understand how it does computation. And to see what kind of real-world applications True North might have, the research team developed a multi-object detection and classification application and tested it with two challenges. One was to detect people, bicycles, cars, trucks, and buses that appear periodically in a video, and the other one was to correctly identify an object. True North proved adept at both tasks. So even if it captures just a fraction of the human brain's complexity, according to its makers, the chip has the brain power of a bumblebee, and that is enough to accomplish some remarkable tasks. For instance, it allows the user to change the channel without the TV or remote control. Let's sell it to the consumer. And Samsung, which has evaluated the True North chip, announced that it already developed a system in which TV users can control their sets by simply gesturing. Officials at Los Alamos have also discussed using it for supercomputing calculations. At some point, Manohar says, I wanted to use mathematics for something more applied, and I thought computer science was interesting from an applied mathematics perspective because a lot of the techniques and some of the foundations are very mathematical. The unprecedented nature of True North has meant a huge amount of resources were put into it. It was a very expensive machine. And not only did the research team invent the chip, but they needed to invent the tools used to build it, since existing computer-assisted design software was not adequate. One of the things that prevents people from working on asynchronous circuits are the lack of tools to design them, but IBM is a big coffer and DARPA is good at funding. So while there is a huge industry that spends billions of dollars each year improving these tools, they are not tailored for the work we are doing on asynchronous design, so we had to write our own CAD tools. Since the unveiling of True North, the number of researchers working on asynchronous circuits has increased significantly, but it's still a very small community. And they can modify these tools to be more universal, and Manohar believes that the field will break out and the technology will advance even more rapidly. So where does this take us? Well, that means neuromorphic computing is going to be spread across the universe. All right, so here you go. So this one also caught me today, February 26, 2018, out of futurism.com. Making AI more secret could prevent us from making it better. So apparently they think to protect us, they should make it more secret so rogue actors can't get their hands on it. Maybe we shouldn't democratize it like we have been. Should the future of our society hinge on a secret? Well, a new report suggests that in order to ensure the safety of a society increasingly reliant upon artificial intelligence, we need to make sure it is kept in the hands of a very select few. Yes, like DARPA, IBM, and Los Alamos, and Google, and Amazon, and Intel, and all the others that are out there, and Apple. Ultimately, though, that decision could do more harm than good. In the report, 20 researchers from several future-focused organizations, including OpenAI, Endgame, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Oxford's Future of Humanity Institute, and the Center for New American Security, expressed the fear that in the wrong hands, AI could cause the downfall of society. Everybody have a lot of fear because we're going to take control of this. The fact is, the report outlined several scenarios like smarter phishing scams, malware epidemics, and robot assassins that haven't even happened yet and don't seem too far off of the realm of possibility. That's why they argue AI's inner workings may need to remain secret to keep the technology out of the quote-unquote bad guys' hands. Yes. And the report suggests that a regulatory agency or the AI research community of their own volition could do this by considering different openness models. These models would shift the AI research community away from the current environment of increasing transparency, where publishing algorithms or making them open source is becoming more common. And instead, the researchers recommend abstaining or delaying the publications of AI findings to restrict their dissemination to parties who would use them with less than admirable intentions. We can probably all agree that it isn't such a good idea to clear the path for malicious actors. I knew they'd use that term. To use AI, which is a recent spate of cyber attacks across the globe, certainly shows that we should be afraid, be very afraid of the cyber hackers living under your bed and in your closet, and that they are certainly out there and willing to use whatever tools are available to them. But restricting access to AI will not prevent people or evildoers from gaining access to it. In fact, it may inhibit people trying to use it for good. And first, the researchers don't say much about how likely it is that their Black Mirror-esque scenario is in the future. But UK analyst John Collins points out in a blog on that we can all conjure disaster scenarios, but some better than others. But it is not until we apply our expertise and experience to assess the risk that we can prioritize and hopefully mitigate any risk that will emerge. Plus, artificial intelligence research is already shrouded in secrecy. Companies from Google to Microsoft to Amazon mostly shrouded their algorithm under the protective blanket of proprietary information and copyrights. And today, most AI researchers have been unable to replicate AI studies, which still makes it hard for researchers to establish how scientifically trustworthy they are. There are those compelling reasons to be more rather than less open about AI, how AI works. And researchers have discovered that machine learning AIs trained on human data have echoed the biases of their creators, such as associating a person's race with more potential for criminal activity or a gender with a success in a career. Experts have suggested that the solution could, in fact, be the opposite of what the authors of this report recommend. And that would be that companies should open this black box at the core of AI, letting researchers examine each other's code, and that is the only way for AI systems to become more just. But the more openness about AI algorithms could also make AI systems more secure, less susceptible to hacks, or to being reverse engineered by terrorists. And this might be accomplished by a system of checks and balances, or putting it on the blockchain or something of that nature, in which AI is tested by experts on an algorithm safety board before being released, the way a drug is tested in clinical trials. And yeah, look how that's worked out for you, before it becomes available to the public, like gadolinium. As the report suggests, researchers would probably think twice about making all AI information open by default. And that would be a bit like shooting yourselves in the foot in the race against hackers and malicious actors. But rather than a hunker behind proprietary shields, companies should build stronger systems by working on them together. And the report recommends actively seeking to expand the range of stakeholders and domain experts involved in discussions of these challenges, and the AI algorithms themselves could likely benefit from the same collaboration. Well, how funny is that, that these same people who are trying to hide what's going on in AI are the same people who are building our surveillance future. Artificial intelligence is everywhere. This is out of the WashingtonTimes.com. Watching almost all modern day human behaviors. February 20th, 2018. One of the problems in demystifying artificial intelligence is that once an AI-based product reaches the public, we stop calling it AI. Instead, we call it a GPS. And this is true. It is a significant truth because it means the world of AI stays mired in the average person's mind as something of a science fiction character, a Terminator programmed to kill, a Matrix hero designed to liberate, or a Star Wars robot set to serve. But AI is not the same as a robot. Yeah, remember, there's the ghost in the machine, and then the tin can and the skin job. Simply put, AI is everywhere. And people ought to know, the average person ought to be aware, it is guiding GPS and Google's Maps, and it is on Facebook, it is on Google, it is driving Spotify and Pandora, it is running at Amazon Online, and it is on smartphones and smart TVs, and it'll be in your cameras soon. And in a sense, AI is watching and recording almost all modern-day human behavior. Ever wonder where all those recommendations come from when you buy a book on Amazon or watch a movie online? Well, that is AI at work, taking note of your selections and doing behavioral monitoring and data processing to determine similarities that might interest you, selections within the same genre, selections commonly chosen by others. And what is more, is this is AI with a thinking cap honing its recommendations based on your behaviors and your selections. The more you engage, the more you choose, the smarter AI grows. Don't feed the machine, people. And the more targeted it is in recommending things both for you and with you. All right, guys, have an awesome Wednesday.